Rex Ingram, visionary director of The Silent Screen, is a new book exploring the art of Irishman and pioneer of cinema, who directed classics such as The Four Horsemen of the Apocalypse, The Prisoner Zenda and Scaramouche. The book is written by Ruth Barton, who's with me in studio this evening. Ruth, before we get into the nuts and bolts of what you've covered in the book, how would you characterise or how would you describe what Rex Ingram did in a very important decade in the movie industry, and in just a decade he made a huge name for himself?
Yeah, it's hard to imagine now because people haven't heard of him so much. It's hard to imagine that he was one of the most famous directors in Hollywood in the 1920s. That's the decade you're referring to. And that's a really crucial decade for Hollywood too, because it's the moment where film just really reached its potential. And so it really starts for him in 1921 with the release of The Four Horsemen of the Apocalypse, which is, if anybody's heard of one Rex Ingram film, that's the one they've heard of. Because not only is it this magnificent film about World War One, it's also the equivalent of the contemporary blockbuster. It's massive in scale, it's massive in achievement, and it has a huge, huge star in it, which was Valentino.
Was this Valentino's first appearance, or certainly his?
It was first appearance as a star. He was pretty much unknown before this, and after this, he was just massive. And so all these things kind of came together in 1921. And Rex Ingram was only 27 when he made this film, which again is just extraordinary to think of. And these were the days, special effects were done by hand. They were done, there was no such thing as CGI. Mm. And, a cast of thousands, people speaking different languages, everything came together. And that was 1921.
We were in the silent movie era.
So that's 1921. And that made his name. And then he went on to make a whole series of films that one after another made A, masses of money, and B, each one the critics were just lining up to praise. And so you get The Conquering Power, as you say, Prisoner of Zenda, Scaramouche, and right through the 20s, one hit after the other.
All right. The thing that we can quite happily claim is that one Rex Ingram, or as he was known then, Reginald Ingram Montgomery Hitchcock, believe it or not, is of Irish descent.
Oh, absolutely. He was completely Irish. His father was a Church of Ireland director. His mother was Irish. She was the Ingram. And the Hitchcock thing does confuse people. And he was, let's get this one out here now, he was no relation to any other Hitchcock who was a famous film director. It just happens to be coincidence. And so he changed his name to his mother's name because she died young, and it was in memory of her. He was born in Rathmines. He grew up first of all in Dublin. And then because his father was a rector, they moved from one parish to another, and he really spent his formative years in Kinnity, in the Irish Midlands, in Offaly.
How would you say that those beginnings of his life in Ireland, because he went to America quite young, how did they inform what then became the great filmmaker of the 1920s?
I think they're really, really important, and I think on the one hand, okay, he didn't make any Irish films in terms of Irish settings, Irish characters, Irish stories. He did want to make Dracula, which is one of the great unmade films. Ingram makes Dracula would have been fabulous. Bram Stoker's Dracula.
If we think that he was from that Church of Ireland background, so it was very much a similar background to that whole Irish Gothic production.
And very much. And his neighbours when he lived in Kinnity, one of the family's good friends was the family who lived in Lepp Castle, which is now a ruin, but people may know it. And Mildred Darby, who was the wife of Jonathan Darby, and the Darbys lived in Lepp Castle, was an occultist, and she wrote supernatural tales. And he grew up hearing, on the one hand, the villages with the kind of superstition and those kind of stories coming into, and then on the other hand, these kind of last relics of the ascendancy with that Gothic tradition that Dracula comes out of, and all those Irish Gothic tales come out of, and so he was. All this was kind of, I think, coming together, and so what you get is when he turned to filmmaking, his films nearly all have some kind of supernatural twist. They're very gothic in look. They're visually very, very rich. Some of them are out-and-out horror stories like The Magician, and others, there's a supernatural intervention that comes in.
When and why, then, did he move to the US?
Well, he remarkably, for the son of a Church of Ireland director, failed to get his place at Trinity. He failed maths, but he was unhappy. His mother had died. He wasn't happy at home, and he was a poor scholar. And I think he wanted to travel. And one of the things that distinguished him throughout his life was he had a very restless nature and loved travel. So he upped and left without a qualification to his name, pretty much. Went to America, worked as a manual labourer very briefly before his his father chipped in and paid for him to go to Yale, where he studied sculpture. And he started sculpture, loved it, but got tempted by the early moving picture industry and moved to New York.
And he was handsome, he was charismatic, so he actually started life out as an actor. Was that quite a brief spell, or did he do well as an actor?
He wasn't a great actor. He photographed well, but he was always rather wooden in front of the camera. Apparently he used to love doing little cameos, which reminds us of the other Hitchcock too, in his films. And his editor, Grant Whitehead, always took them out because they were kind of clumsy and awkward.
You mentioned that he studied sculpture, a bit like the Irish question I asked. To what extent do you think, obviously it's a fixed, steady, still form, but it is nevertheless a very visual form. How did that inform his filmmaking?
It informed it very much, and it was something that he did deliberately. He wanted to give film that sense of three-dimensionality that sculpture has. And so what he did was he filled in his sets with light, and he used lighting to give that sense of three-dimensionality. So when you look, if you freeze frame any of his images, you'll see there's light streaming down the back, it's coming in the sides, often there's smoke kind of drifting across the set, and you'd have windows behind windows. He uses mats. He uses,
He'd be using 3D if he were alive.
If he could see the toys that he might have had, he'd be going mad for them.
All right, we were talking a lot about Rex Ingram, filmmaker, but there's no doubt that Rex Ingram, man about town, was quite an interesting character as well. How would you characterise his personal life?
Chaotic and very, very exotic. And he's somebody I found that I couldn't pin him down. I couldn't pigeonhole him into, one kind of personality, because I kept coming up with all these contradictions. He seems to have been a very genial host, but if you fell out of him, you were cut. Absolutely. There were no second chances. He loved all the kind of exoticism. He adored travelling in North Africa. And one of the things that, rather surprisingly, perhaps he did, was he converted to Islam in later life. And he loved all that. He was very, very open to meeting people. He had friends of all kinds of sexual persuasions. And yet, in other senses, he was also a man of his times. He was anti-Semitic. He was intolerant of certain types of difference. So I kept coming across all of this. But I think he had a life that, had he stayed in Ireland, he could have never, ever led.
No, he wouldn't have lived that life. And that's all part of the book. That's a colourful aspect too. One of the central stories in Ingram's life is his relationship with Metro-Goldwyn-Mayer and Louis B. de Mayer of that particular studio. What was the problem? Because he was very successful financially and critically, was Ingram. What happened between him and Louis B. de Mayer that caused such problems?
Well, one thing was that he had a trouble with authority figures right from the word go. He went to St. Columbus in Rathfarnham and ran straight away into trouble with the prefect system, with masters telling him what to do. He really resented people interfering with his life. And, of course, Louis B. Mayer was one of the old-fashioned movie moguls. He knew everything that went on in the studio, and he liked to interfere in quite small details. So you have two very, very strong personalities, one who thinks that he can make the greatest films ever made, and the other who thinks he's running the greatest studio ever invented, and they didn't see eye to eye at all, and these incredible flare-ups started between the two men. They just personally couldn't bear each other, and so that was in the end why, although he'd had this incredibly successful career, he then upped and moved to Nice and worked out of Nice.
And was it around that time that he converted to Islam? Was it around the time of the move to France?
A little bit later. So he moved to France in mid-1920s, 25-26. He actually didn't convert to Islam. He didn't announce that he'd converted to Islam until 1932, so a little bit later.
And did the filmmaking continue for very long when he moved to France?
Yes, he made a number of films that are they're French films or they're Hollywood films, whichever way you want to look at them. He made Mare Nostrum. He made The Magician, which I said is a great horror film. Mare Nostrum, which is his other World War One film, an incredible submarine film, and then a series of others. But the only problem was he was falling a little bit out of touch with Hollywood filmmaking, and this began to tell.
What is the legacy then of Rex Ingram in terms of today's filmmakers?
Well, one thing I like to kind of think is that we've got an Irish art cinema that we didn't know we had, and I kind of like to think that we've got a history of filmmaking that we didn't know we had, and that's one of the reasons for writing this book. I think his legacy is that desire, that belief that people could see could enjoy complex, difficult films that were artistically interesting, and that anybody could enjoy great art on the screen, that film was a really proletarian art form. And I think he really, really believed in that, and I think that's his legacy to us.
Ruth Barton has been talking to us about her new book, Rex Ingram, Visionary Director of the Silent Screen. It's published by University Press of Kentucky.